Welcome to Mind the Gap by Fresh Chat, a podcast where experts and hustlers share their stories on growth, marketing, and customer experience. I'm Abhishek, and I'm your host for the day. Today, we have the CEO and founder of an AI company. She bootstrapped her business, then raised capital, and have been successful in maintaining a 50% women in her tech startup. She knows the e-commerce ecosystem and works with few of the biggest brands in the space. Ashwini Ashokan from Match Street Den joins us today to talk about entrepreneurship, scaling your startup, and AI in retail. Welcome to the show, Ashwini. Thank you so much for joining us today. I've heard from a few entrepreneurs about them being lonely, or how entrepreneurship is a lonely ride. What's your take on it?
I concur. There's really no other way to put it. It is extremely lonely. I think it gets lonelier as you continue down that path. You're faced with decisions of all kinds every single day, and oftentimes you can't let that get in the way of your relationships, of your daily functioning, of your team's morale. And, you know, I've said this a lot of times before as well, but I think running a company is like juggling like 10 time bombs, right? There's no other way to put it. I mean, the opportunity, if you get on the other side of this whole experience, I mean, I think there's immense rewards, and the journey itself is extremely rewarding. But I think you're constantly aware that at any point of time, any one of those balls that you're juggling could fall down and just explode on your face. And it will. It's almost 100% probability that it is one of, you're going to keep doing that regularly. And you just got to figure out how to pick yourself up and keep moving. So and you can't take people down with you every time one of those things go off. So you're almost faced with this dilemma of bringing people along for the ride across all kinds of, you know, teams, your customers, your investors. There's so many, your own family. There's so much going on, and you know, you do want to share and be transparent and bring people along for the ride. But at the same time, as someone who runs the company, I think you are faced with the challenge of not putting that on them, right? So it's what makes the journey intensely lonely. I've also, almost along with that loneliness, also comes a lot of self-flagellation, I think. I think founders and CEOs are constantly questioning their worth, if they're doing this right or not. And it's a massive mental struggle, I think, more than anything else. The physical stamina, I think you figure out over the years how to hold on to that. But I think the toll it takes just on your mental health can be pretty immense as well. So, yeah.
But does it make a difference for you having a friend or your better half around, or him being part of a, you know, the co-founding team? Does it make a difference? Any way bring down the loneliness factor?
No, about the loneliness part. Yes, about the helpful part. I think, you know, the two of us, when we started this company, I mean, we'd been sharing ideas about what we want to build for, you know, more than a decade before we actually started this company. But I think it helped us immensely to do this together. I think we kind of are very complementary. If someone is having a really busy day with something, someone else just can just, you know, one of us can just move in and take over everything else very naturally. I think it was a very natural, complementary kind of almost synchronized kind of a dance for the two of us in so many ways. But at the same time, I think the thing is that at the end of the day, he is the CTO, he's not the CEO. And, you know, I think the things he worries about are very different than the things I worry about. And as a result, often, you know, for him, it's all about the tech and the product being absolutely flawless and continuing to improve. And you know, given the choice of compromises, he will almost always pick that over, you know, from a business angle, anything else. And for me, it's the opposite. I mean, business comes first, and doing the right thing for the company, for the business. And these two things are complementary, but they also often come at odds with each other. So the loneliness part, I think, is something that every CEO has to struggle with, because you're up alone at that spot and having to make decisions that you have to live with. And that doesn't take away from the loneliness factor, I think. But yeah, it's I wouldn't have it any other way. I think the two of us founding this company was probably the best thing we've done together. So yeah.
Right. Okay. Now, if you look at your experience of starting Mathstreet, then you've been bootstrapped for some time and then you raised your funding as well. Now, what are your learnings there? And imagine this, if there is a startup there, they probably are unaware of when they should really look for a funding. What would you advise to them?
The two of us were, Anand is a neuroscientist by background. I am a product designer who had been working in AI and with vision for a while. And we were asking a lot of questions around computer vision, image and video recognition. In 2012, we asked ourselves, how can we take tech as complex as this and put it in the hands of people across the globe in a very meaningful, useful way? What is the use of something like computer vision? And we saw, you know, the whole image and video movement coming from, you know, it was coming at us. Like, you know, in the early 2000s, it was coming at us. In the Flickr days, it was coming at us, right? And we've been asking this question of how is image and video essentially going to take over our lives completely? And what is the role of computer vision and image and video recognition as a technology in there? And we've been asking this question for a very long time. And so the reason we, you know, quit our day jobs and kind of decided to go start up and spend about 2 years experimenting is because we were building the technology bottoms up. Our computer vision platform is a completely proprietary platform. We don't use off-the-shelf networks. Almost all of it is built in-house. And we really wanted to understand, you know, how far can you stretch and bend and make this technology useful for people. So for the first 2 years, the reason we were bootstrapped is we were just experimenting away. And it felt, I did have a good decade of a career before that. And thankfully, we had saved up. And I think the saving up part is a really important part of the bootstrapping, I think. Unlike a lot of other early 20-year-olds, I must say, Anand and I had already had kids by then, a pretty big family. And, you know, giving up everything to just go and bootstrap was a huge decision. So I'd say, you know, jumping in without any kind of a backup at all is probably not a great idea, especially if you're in your early to mid-30s and starting up. So that is something. But it really cracked for us one day, right? We were continuously trying out different types of applications. We'd built applications in gaming, in analytics, in e-learning, in children's education. We had tried out a series of POCs and concepts while we were experimenting. And retail was the one that really stuck. And that 2 years into bootstrapping the company is when we decided to raise a round and essentially go after retail. And our retail vertical and brand is called View.ai. And almost everything around life here at Mathstreet then revolves around View.ai. So that's pretty much the brand that we're known with outside in the industry today. And raising rounds of funding was absolutely the right thing to do for us. We've raised about 3 rounds till now, close to about $12 million. And you know, it is a very capital intensive business. Building an AI first, tech first company for us was a very capital intensive kind of approach. But at the same time, I think we've been very quickly, ever since we decided to kind of move into a product first, retail first approach to the company, we've been able to ramp up on the business and the revenue and the retail side of things fairly quickly within a matter of 18 to 24 months. So, yeah, that's where we are today.
Okay. Now, FreshChat, at least from my perspective, right? So FreshChat works with a lot of retail businesses, right? We work with a lot of e-commerce companies. And I personally want to know, what is your take on AI in retail? Where are the gaps today and where do you think this can be filled? Or how do you think this can be filled?
So the way we think about this is that everything about retail is very visual, right? It's all about products, the products you see, the way you interact with things around, materials around you in the world. Everything is so visual. But if you really think about how retail operates, it's still largely in a text-centric world. All data is textual. Everything is manual. And automatically, as a result, the data being generated across different retail processes are flawed because so many people are handling any kind of data, right? So whether it's catalog data, whether it's product data, whether it's user behavior data, in-store data, online data, email data, notifications data, you can go on and on and on and on. And I think that no two departments in retail often talk to each other. Data doesn't flow seamlessly across different functions. And almost everything, so many people come in and out of these processes, and all of that, where's all that data going, right? There's one, there's inconsistency in all the data across retail functions. Two, there is none of it is necessarily being captured and used up in a consistent way across different retail functions. So for example, the buying department is making choices. It's not always being influenced by the data that the marketing team or the selling team, the team that's actually, you know, selling all this stuff, you know, all of these different data, they're very disparate in their nature. And we saw a huge opportunity here for computer vision and an image recognition platform to play a role in automating all of these processes, right? Whether it's automatically attributing product data, right? So the minute a catalog team gets access to, is putting together a catalog or deciding what to buy from which merchant or which seller, Vue.ai can automatically tag all that, all those products. It can tell you, you know, how many red clothing do you have? How many polka dotted stuff do you have? You know, what work last trend? What? So everything is automatically recognized. All you have to do is to just upload a product and it's automatically attributed, title and descriptions are generated, metadata is automatically created, and then it moves into, you know, product digitization and photography where Vue.ai's algorithms generate human models. So you don't really need to do fashion photography or modeling anymore. And so there's a whole product digitization process that Vue.ai completely handles. And it means that data that anybody across any other retail function uses is now going to be consistent. Your search and discovery experience from a user or a shopper perspective becomes much better because someone comes in and looks for, you know, cold-shouldered, red-sleeved, polka-dotted, you know, shift sack or shirt dress. Somebody looks at something and now all of that is accurate. So someone's actually able to find it. So the automation that we do actually has implications across the entire value chain. So Vue.ai has products for catalog management, for product digitization, for merchandising, for marketing, for product management, for user experience. So it's the same platform, but we have a series of products that go across the entire value chain. And we believe that computer vision, image recognition and video recognition are actually the primary tools or the underlying technology that can help bring retail into this new age.
So you really are the one who's making me spend a lot more online.
What?
If I have to talk about one line that kind of summarizes the way, you know, at least the market looks at you, or at least the media looks at you, you're a woman co-founder of an artificial intelligence company who doesn't write a single line of code. 50% of employees at Match Street Den are women. You know, you are fighting stereotypes everywhere. Is that a natural rebel in you, or how did this all come together?
Yes. I don't know any other way to put it, but I feel like I've been doing this ever since I've known me. But I think this is not something that's exclusive to me. I think people across the world do it. It's a struggle, but it's also very freeing for me. People don't expect to see me. Customers don't expect to see me. Investors don't expect to see this package when I show up for fundraise or pitches or whatever it is. People expect. We run an enterprise retail AI startup. So on multiple forums, I think this is kind of just going against what one would expect. And it's a challenge because it does involve breaking barriers, breaking biases that people don't even realize that there is, or they're reacting a certain way because of a certain thing. And it's been a pretty steep hike for me, to be honest. You know, I spent years on media of all kinds talking about, you know, these stereotypes and how to break them and the experiences that I've had and being really open about it. And I honestly am probably in a slightly different phase of my of that journey. I feel like I've voiced out a lot. There's nothing left to say in terms of, not just for me, but for anybody who's spoken about this topic. There's nothing left that's not been written about this topic. And I'm probably in that phase where everything is all about action for me right now, right? I feel like it's out of my system. I've gotten it out of my system. I've moved on. And to me, being able to role model what success looks like is my singular goal right now. I think there's only, like, it helps to play, you know, voicing the stories of the victim side of the thing. I think it helped me immensely understand the situation, what are the stereotypes and going through that journey myself. But I feel like every step of the way, I've broken a lot of barriers along the way. And to me, I feel like I have a lot of very actionable ways in which I can move ahead, despite the stereotypes. And, I think the success of the company, the success of the team, the fact that we are a computer vision company with greater than 50% women in it is absolutely a personal achievement for me. We continue. I mean, it is not getting in the way of our fundraise. We have some fantastic investors on board between Sequoia and Xfinity, and we've added a lot of new investors to our list as well, and customers as well. We work with some of the most awesome brands out there. And so for me personally, I think this year and the end of last year has really been about moving past the experiences and the awareness that I had to kind of go through to getting to this point where saying, hey, you know, it has to have a set of very actionable ways to move forward, to continue to break this, right? And yes, the rebel in me has been alive and kicking for a very long time, but I feel like I'm definitely in a slightly different zone of my career right now. I feel very in control of, breaking through these barriers without not a lot of effort. And it's a privilege to be here. And there's a lot of people that have helped me along the way in breaking those barriers. And, you know, it's not something that's isolated to me. I think the whole world has been watching this. All the movements that have been going on. So I see only one way forward, and things are looking better than they ever have before.
Cool. On the next round, we have something called the rapid fire or the lightning round.
All right. Okay. Let's go.
I think it's going to be fun. So who are the founders that you look up to?
There aren't big idols for me, but I'm constantly drawing from a variety of entrepreneurs out there, right? Like I very closely follow enterprise companies primarily. Like I've been watching the journey of VMware. I've been watching the journey of Dropbox. I've been watching the journey of Box. Here in India, I've been very closely tracking, you know, Girish and Sridhar's journeys. I think there's inspiration everywhere, to be very honest with you. And for someone, again, as someone that's breaking or trying to break a lot of the stereotypes and barriers across, you know, gender or enterprise or AI, there is a lot of category firsts or firsts here for me. And, I don't have the luxury of hanging my hat on one founder and saying, you know, this person is my idol. I actually have to constantly look for inspiration across all of these different types of spaces, right? And there are so many different people, I think, across each one of these.
Great. Okay. Now, if you're not reading a book, where do you look for inspiration?
You know, I listen to a lot of podcasts. The problem with me and books and podcasts or blogs is that like one paragraph or 3 minutes into a podcast or just a handful of pages into a book, I'm usually just exploding with ideas or my brain's going off and hitting off in so many different angles that, you know, it's sometimes it's very disruptive. Again, another very, probably a very different way to answer the question you're asking, but oftentimes I find myself shutting off a lot of this. Given the default state is me listening to all of this or soaking in all of this, I actually find inspiration in a lot of silence. As someone who's constantly traveling between different countries, I think, and spending a large chunk of my time out here in India, I think silence is something that I yearn for. I yearn for a lot of silence. And I think the kind of creative energy that silence can bring, it allows you to process all of this stuff that you listen on podcasts or blogs at events, on webinars, on books. And I'm usually, like I mentioned, I'm usually surrounded by sketches. I'm constantly sketching out my ideas. I'm surrounded by notes. I'm surrounded by stickies. I'm surrounded by storyboards. And to me, these things are probably the most important source of ideation and inspiration. I also have a design background, so that might also explain some of my bias towards.
Right. Okay. I'm not going to have this part of the podcast, but so that I can start listening to them as well. What are the podcasts that you listen to?
I am a big fan of the A16Z podcast. It's huge for me. I draw inspiration from that podcast like crazy. Sonal is just amazing. And just the kind of stuff they discuss is just incredible. And I think that reminds me, Ben Horowitz's Hard Things About Hard Things is definitely one of my top books. I think especially as somebody building an enterprise company, I think his stories really resonated with me. And so that is something so that is one of my favorite podcasts. I would be lying if I didn't bring up Jason Lemkin's podcast. I know that's a bit of a cliche there, a super cliche there for somebody who's in B2B. But yes, I really, really like the content that's discussed there. It's very accessible. It's very actionable. And that's what I really love about that. These are definitely two of my top favorites.
Okay. Now, you service a lot of brands, a lot of e-commerce companies at least. And which brand do you think gives the best buying experience?
That's not fair. That is not fair at all. It's like asking you to pick which of your children is the most favorite.
It need not be your customer for sure.
Aspirationally, I think, I actually think that there's something about Macy's and what's going on with Macy's that is just incredible. A company that was very old school, has been around for such a long time and largely been known for the amount of real estate it owned. And today I think it's incredible how much change is going on there. As someone that's up front and center and that gets to watch a lot of that change, I for one, am a huge fan. It's you know, it's like a really large corporation that's steering a ship away from an iceberg. And there is no other way to put it, right? And when that happens, I mean, you know, I think Adobe comes to mind and the way Adobe kind of reinvented itself, the way IBM reinvented itself at one point. And you know, there's something happening in Macy's that reminds me of that. I think just sitting there and watching that, I think, has been very incredible. And you know, reading about that stuff, you know, listening to their execs talk about it at various events, and I'm incredibly excited about that. It is a very old school brand that's reinventing itself, I think, in fascinating new ways. I'm also really excited to watch luxury brands. That is again another segment that, you know, people are looking at it and going, oh my God, luxury brands are dead. You know, people are not going to pay that kind of money anymore. It's so old school. But I think, you know, the idea of being able to look at the latest releases in the store. It might not seem like a big thing for online retailers and stuff, but the entire supply chain, the entire way in which the merchandising, the buying process works in the luxury industry is changing in ways that we can't even begin imagining. And I think this is, again, that's another fascinating thing. Watching the luxury brands closely, and I mean the Gucci's and the Burberry's, I think it's fascinating to watch that change. And then the last but not the least, the other set of segment that I am personally very excited by is the movement for the whole consignment, secondhand, reseller, you know, the sharing economy market, and what's going on there with retail, I think is another really fascinating thing to watch, right? Ever since the recession and all the changes in the way people are perceiving buying and you know, the move from being very materialistic to the move towards, you know, sustainable movements towards reusing stuff, recycling stuff, and what the retail industry and the different types of companies across the globe that are doing in that space, I think is another fascinating thing to watch for. It's definitely indicative of, you know, what's going to come down the line between DIY and recycling products and reusing products, sharing products. I think that movement is just beginning, and I think it's going to go crazy, if you ask me. So
I think I met this company. I think it's called Bunce, and they're from Canada. And what they work on is on recycling as well. So they are an e-commerce company which believes in barter system. And if you have something and you want to recycle it, and if I have something else, you can say, hey, I'm ready to recycle mine. Would you give me this from yours? And you build a laundry list. So you're a lot more cleaner every day. You know things that you're not using. You can put it up. And when people find it, they just say, hey, I want to take this and I can give you this instead. And I think that's a beautiful way to look at it as well, outside of the monetary ecosystem.
Absolutely. I mean, we work with companies like ThredUp and Real and so many different you know, companies that work in the consignment and reseller and, you know, space, and it's incredible to see, you know, it's incredible to see what's going on there, right? And I think it's a growing segment. It's definitely growing, and like I said, between DIY and the ability to take anything and make it into anything you want, and this whole recycling sustainable movement that's going on, I think some fascinating things are going to come out of it.
Lovely. Last question. So we do this all the time in the Fresh Chat team, right? When a new member joins the team and we ask them to share something weird about them. What's something weird about you?
Oh my God. Something weird about me. I don't know. It depends on the day, to be honest with you. There are days when I just sit around wondering if everything about me is weird. Especially the loneliness and the journey itself can do that to you. It can make you crazy and think everything about you is weird. But I don't know if this constitutes as weird, but I'm a total stationery addict. I collect stationery like crazy. Like, I've got hundreds of post-its and pens and, you know, sticky notes and sketches that I'm constantly doing. And I'm every chance I find, you know, an empty notepad or a pen sitting around, you know, I'm off picking it up and using it. So beware of stationery around me. Beware of leaving your stationery around me.
That's a whole lot of questions that we ended up asking her. Thank you so much for your time today, Ashwini. Entrepreneurs who are listeners, shoot us a tweet at Fresh Chat App and tell me what your biggest takeaways have been. Thank you for listening to Mind the Gap. Subscribe to our podcast at freshchat.com/mindthegap. You can check out our upcoming episodes and ask questions to our guest by sending an audio message there. If you enjoyed today's episode, share it with the world. See you guys soon.